Sandra Lundström, this is
hello.
Our next exploration, huh?
Yes.
The exploration is about money?
Yeah.
It's a bit of a tricky exploration because in a way it feels like visiting a weird culture who have all kind of superstitions. And they cart somebody up an artificial mountain to rip out their hearts, or they bring the young damsels to the village square to burn them, or they bring in the blood leeches into the house to allegedly heal somebody. There's many practices that we see nowadays of which we look back on the past and basically say, well, that's not it. And for me, money is like that. It is something very primitive from a very far remote past. And there is a lot I had to reconsider in order to be able to get out of the mental trap which is associated with money, because it's like I often say, it's like people believing in Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, the Tooth Fairy, and more. And they just keep on insisting that it's true, and they keep on pretending that it's real. The difference between Santa Claus is that from one night to the other, everybody gets out of the superstition. In the Easter Bunny, there's fewer people who even participate in it. How can a bunny lay eggs is one of the phrases on that. At some point people know that there's something not quite right. With money, it is a superstition which has become so pervasive that people in a way no longer question it. So when I started to question it, basically when the financial crash came in the United States and suddenly the whole world seemed to have this money problem. Everybody was talking about economics and banks too big to fail, and that was a lot of deception because it had nothing to do with the money, it had nothing to do with the banks, but it all had to do with the production of money and the role of a different kind of banks, which is the banks who produce the money. And then when I started to look at that, I realized, thanks to the help of many others who had put this story together for me already, that money is basically just scrap metal and scrap paper. As you can experience when you go from one country to the other, the first experience that you have is, do they actually believe this stuff? This colored paper is what they want to receive for the bread that they produced. Why would anybody do that? And at the moment that you realize that, you also see that there's no difference between the colored bits of paper that they use in that country and the colored piece of paper that they use in a game such as Monopoly. That's just not real. But there is something in the mind where people switch from the understanding that it is real to it is not real, or the other way around. So anytime new money is introduced, people sort of look at it with a reprehensive kind of way, and a moment later they're using it as if it's worth something, and they might sell their life for it or sell somebody else's life for it. I discovered that there's a lot wrong with money, and there are so many topics involved that I wrote a separate text on it, which you can find in the website Purgatory, which is part of the plantingparadise.org website. And perhaps it's easiest if I sort of recapitulate what I came up with. Then the story goes back, far back, say 6,000 years. That's the time of the Egyptians and the Babylonians doing their trading. And there are very many aspects involved before money became what we know it as now, but never did anything change at the level of the production of money. Money is without value. Money is just a symbol, and that is the most basic explanation I have for the foundation of money. It's part of the Egyptian magic. There's creational magic, there's ceremonial magic, ritual magic, symbolic magic, and Egyptian magic, sleight of hand. Creational magic is that you're able to conjure something out of nothing. Conjuring magic is another word for it. So you use a deception by which it appears as if something is happening, which is not the case. And for money, that is the basic message of all of it. What you see is not what is happening. Essentially, that makes it part of the occult, because in the occult, the study of the occult, it is always known that whatever you look at, don't assume that that is what you're seeing. So for example, if you see a flower, you might well think that that's the flower that you see, but if you don't look far enough, you do not understand that the flower is actually the seed from which the plant grew, turned inside out. So the flower is actually the seed turned inside out. So you need to have occult understanding to look beyond the form that you see, to get an understanding of the form that you do not see. And with money, that is definitely the case, because what you see in money is not what is. It's just scrap metal, scrap paper. And it is the making of the money that you need to look at. And at that level, you can see that people go to the bank and tell the bank, I want money. And so the banker, of course, inwardly is surprised. Well, why would they come here and why would they want that? Because if they knew how I make money, then they would do it themselves. So, okay, dear sir, dear madam, there you are. And how can I help you? Well, as I said, I want money. And so the banker evidently says, well, what for? And the client does not exist, that actually is not a client, but just a visitor into a museum or a curiosity shop, and doesn't understand that the question, what for, which actually means, well, why would you come to me then? Why don't you produce your own money? The question is misunderstood, and so they say, well, I want to do something using money. And so the banker, with a kind of understanding, says, well, what is it what you would like to do? So people then make these business plans and come back to the banker a couple of weeks, a couple of months later, and say, well, hey, you asked me what I wanted to do, and this is what I did. So the banker, of course, is again surprised, because he was just curious what they would want to do with this money that they want from the banker, which they could actually make themselves. So he was just wondering why they would need somebody else to empower them and what they can do themselves. And of course, he's even more surprised that people then come with this business plan and maybe even hired lawyers to formulate the business plan for them. Because why would people need to tell the banker of what they need to do? But then, once caught up in the game, the banker, of course, said, well, this is an interesting plan. If I look at it, this sort of looks feeble, or that might be a bit risky. And so people rewrite it and rewrite it and rewrite it, and they start to believe in this business plan, and they start to think that the bank is actually commenting on their business plan, while the bank is a surprise at what people are telling them. Because why would they write that whole business plan and come to the bank? Because they can make their own money. But that's the whole snag of the story. People do not know that they can make their own money. So out of this lack of knowledge, they come to the bank and think that they need to get money at the bank, and think that they need to argue the case why they would get the money. And then they present a case to the bank, who at that time is no longer a bank, but in fact a judge of the morality of what these people might want to do. So there is a moral judgment by the banker on the truth or the realness of what people want to do in their business plan. And it's not about if it is ethical or if it is meaningful, is it relevant or truthful. But at that time, the only criterion is that, okay, people want to get money and they show something that they want to do for that money. I call it a survival gimmick. There's something that they want to do for money. One plays the flute, another juggles something, another shows their breasts, or how they can skateboard it in a fast car, whatever. Everybody has thought up something by which they can get some token of appreciation by others in the form of money. So that's also what the bank gives, a token of appreciation in the form of money. But the banker, differently than anybody else in society, says, well, you want to have, say, 10 chits of my money, and you're going to do all these wonderful things, you say. You know what? I can give you those 10 chits. And then at some point you bring them back. But of course, while I've given you those 10 chits, I cannot give them to somebody else. So I suggest that you bring me back more chits than I'm giving you, so that I can give those to others. And that's called interest. I take an interest in you, you take an interest in me, other people have interest in my bank, so you pay interest by paying me more money than I'm giving you. And people don't realize that that's actually where the problem lies. That the bank reads that business plan and then goes to its printer and prints out so many numbers of whatever the other wants, and then gives that to the other and saying, well, okay, here you have the money that you asked for, and now I want to have X percent of that money extra apart from the money that they give you. And of course the other people cannot give that back because the banker never gave them that money. The banker never gave other people that money. So that money, that so-called interest money, was never created. So when banks ask for that interest money, they're actually saying, well, I'm going to give you an impossible task because you're going to give me more than I gave you. So just imagine that you're on a planet, and on the whole planet is one green stone. That's the one green stone. There's only one of it. There's no other green stone. And the banker then says, okay, I give you this green stone, but I want to have 1.5 green stone back. Well, the other half green stone doesn't exist on the planet, so it can never be given back. So whatever people pay in interest, they cannot give back. So the only way that they can give back that interest to the bank is that they take it from somebody else. And in that approach, I make a distinction between vertical money and horizontal money. So vertical money is what people get from the banker. It goes, say, up and down. And horizontal money is that what is exchanged from hand to hand between people. So if you go to a bank and borrow money and you say you need to pay one chit extra back, but you don't have it, you never got it, it's not available, then the only way you can get it back is by the horizontal interaction with between other people. So somehow you must persuade these other peoples, and as they say, by hook or by crook, somehow you must convince them that you are worth a chit. And in some way you must persuade somebody to give a chit, which actually they don't have. They don't know that it is your missing chit that you never got. They think it's part of the 10 chits that you did get. So they thought that you're just exchanging the chits that you have with the chits that they have. And they don't know that it's like musical chairs. But at the moment that they give you their one chit, you pull the chair out from under them and they go bankrupt because they cannot pay back the bank that chit, because you now pay back that chit to the bank, and so somebody else is one chit short of what the banks gave them. In that sense, the interest rate in a country is the rate of how people will go bankrupt for the simple reason that that money was never made. So there is a fundamental problem in money, that whatever people get from the bank as money, of what people have to pay back to the bank as money, it doesn't add up. There's always a gap. And so that is where this is called debt money. It is definitely associated with the Judeo-Christian philosophy. Basically that people are born from a wrathful God. Whatever you do, it's wrong. It's never good enough. There's a strong narcissistic moral in that part of the story. So if you get something from that God, then whatever you do, it will not suffice. So you will be in a debt. I need to add some further backgrounds to this, because I tried to understand how this kind of money originated. Specifically, I tried to understand how this notion of debt money was created. And I realized that there are a lot of different components which form part of that story. And they relate to what happened in Egypt and in Babylon. So I need to go and switch the story a bit from the creation of money to the administration of money. The story about the interest and the debt was just to illustrate that the creation of money is incomplete, because while the money is being created, there's also a shortage of money being created. So everybody who uses money of those kind of banks, and the Rothschilds bank is basically the one Jewish bank on the planet which creates all of that. And by the Jewish tradition, there is some game rules on that. Because in the Bible, there is the description that Jews between them cannot charge interest. Jews are allowed to charge interest only to Goyim, the non-Jews. And in that way, the Jews basically profiteer of everybody else, because between themselves, the Jews have money and it just goes around interest-free. And then everybody else has to pay interest, so everybody else has to produce extra to support and uphold the Jews for this conjuring magic game. But there is an understanding where this profiteering of others comes out of the history of Egypt, and that's where I looked back at what happened at the time of Cain and Abel. The story is that Cain, the meat eater, murdered Abel. No, it was the other way. Cain was the vegetarian, Abel was the meat eater. And so then it was said that Cain was the bad guy, and Abel, the poor sod who died out of being mistreated by his brother. If you look back in the history of Egypt, there is an immense difference between what happens in the Nile Delta area and the desert area. So there is a very strong difference between what happens in the river bedding and what happens outside of that. The people who live in the Nile Delta and along the River Nile, they always have water available. Every year at that time, the river would rise and the mud would settle on the river bank. The sand would be made very fertile, crops would grow, people basically just would have to replant things, food was abundant, and abundance is the theme of what they experienced. And the associated part of that is generosity, and the associated principle of that is called the loving God. So in Egypt you have two regions and two kind of experience and two kinds of God. So where in the river area, you have this abundance and a loving God. In the desert area, you have this wrathful God and the principle of sparsity. If you look in the desert, you can see nothing grows there. And if you need to live there and nothing grows there, the only way to survive is what has resulted in people eating animals, which can eat animals, which can eat algae or can eat whatever, so that they can survive in the desert. So the desert tribes are then the meat eaters. They live off whatever is going around. And so when somebody from the desert goes from one oasis to the other and happily leads his bleating sheep along, and think of the image of the Catholic Church and the pastors being the shepherds of the bleating sheep, then the sheep will not all reach the destination because they are the lunch package of the people traveling. So the people living in the desert, the meat eaters, also had some other principles, because surviving in the desert is tricky business. You have to be very careful with the water. Resources are never good enough. You have to be very strict and stringent on everything. And so their God is a wrathful God. It is never good enough. You have to be very careful. Whatever you do can be wrong. So the principle of God and devil, or Horus and Seth, is also associated with the rising sun and the setting sun. If you are in the delta, then on the side of the rising sun, there is more fertile land than on the side of the setting sun. So the sun has two different meanings depending on which direction you go. In Old Egyptian, the word westing actually means dying, which is equivalent to getting lost in the desert and dying. And there is a book called Saharasia, which is about the difference between the Sahara, the desert tribes, and Asia, the delta tribes. So I prefer to call it the desert and the delta. In the desert, their sparsity is never good enough. There's sand around, and if you want to live, you have to kill something so that you can live. In the delta, everything is abundant. The flood will come by. Everything will grow. You can harvest whatever you need. Everybody is fed. It's the good stuff. At some point, there was this conflict between the tribes of the desert and the tribe of the delta. Yes, they have their different gods, but they also have the different customs. So, for example, circumcision of the men and the boys of the boys and the girls was a delta desert tradition, and in the delta they didn't much care for that. They didn't need that, and the circumcision was more to mark people to be one tribe or the other. So the ring of discernment is basically the foreskin being cut off, which is of course silly, because if you pull back the foreskin, it'll stretch up and you never need to cut it off anyhow. So they use that to discern between their tribes and other people. So these people from the desert at some point took their cattle and had it graze on the fields of the farmers of the delta. That led to a conflict. That conflict is described as the conflict between Cain and Abel. And essentially the vegetarian was the victim of the meat eater grazing the cattle on the field of the vegetarians, as a result of which the vegetarians no longer had food, and the desert tribe suddenly had very fat cattle. And that story then led to a battle between the desert tribe and the delta tribe. And the story of Cain, Abel, of course, puts it the wrong way around. As you get it in history, the victor will rewrite the story so that it suits them. And so essentially you can say that it was the meat eaters who clobbered the vegetarians. And at some point you see that the kings of Upper Egypt and Lower Egypt, again, desert versus delta, were combined. Had the desert tribe had conquered the delta tribe, and so from that moment on, the pharaohs have their hands crossed in front of their chest, and in one hand they have a shepherd's staff, and in the other hand they have a flail. So the flail symbolizes the instrument by which the delta tribe could get their grains cleaned up, and the shepherd's staff is the instrument by which the desert tribe would guide their animals. Evidently, the holding of animals then led to a system of slavery, because if you are killing animals to live, and if you're having animals in captivity to live, then having people in captivity is just a consequence of that. And the banking system is actually just that. So let me give a picture of how this principle works of the hunting of the animal, because that's also the picture that you see at work now in the banking business, in much of the politics of the banking business-based societies. Just imagine that you're in the desert, and there is a nice picture of a South African who is chasing an animal in the desert, and by continuing to chase the animal, at some point the animal can no longer escape, for the simple reason that the skin of the animal is too thick and it cannot sweat enough. The human skin allows for sweating in a better way, so while the animal runs away, it is being chased by the hunter, and at some point the animal just simply cannot run further away because it's overheating, and it just stalls down, it shuts down, after which the hunter can catch the animal. In order to be able to find the animal, the hunter first must know where the animal will be. So the meat eater, the hunter, will at some point have to do some kind of administration of finding out where the animals are. So evidently the drinking places are good places to look for animals. And then if you know what time of day it is and what day of the season it is, then you can have a good guess of what kind of animals will be there at the time that you're at that drinking place. So once you have that, you can go to the drinking place and follow the spoor, the trail of the animal, and chase it until it stops and drops. And that's what you see at the moment, that the internet has become the drinking place, and that everybody's leaving their spoor, and that the hunters have set up a cache industry in which they can track and trace everybody, so that they will always know when they can harvest. And that harvesting, or the harvesting of souls, as it is called in a more Vatican-based language, again, think of the Vatican as the pastors with the shepherd staff, which is the meat eaters collecting animals for their dinner. Then you can see that the meat eater tribes conquered the vegetarian tribes and put all of the techniques that they used for catching the animals in place to keep the humans in place. So let me add a couple of steps that in the meat eating tribes took place. So of course, if you know where the water well is, and if you know what time of day and what day of year it is, then you can either track the animal and catch it then, or you can wait at the water well and catch it there. Both techniques are now used in this society in disguises to basically control the population. At some point, the hunters also realized that they could, instead of chasing the animals, they could use fire to chase the animals, and in a one way they could run them over the cliff so that they could get to the meat, the carcass, where the animals had dropped down, so that would save them a lot of running. On the other hand, the hunters also realized that instead of chasing the animals off the cliff, they could chase them into a canyon and then put fences at the end of the canyon, and that's where the first animal husbandry farm then originated. So the animals discovered that they were locked up. Of course, soon they would have eaten up all the grass. The hunters would then throw over the grass which they had harvested from the vegetarians, and in that way the vegetarians were the crew who fed the animals, and the animals fed the meat eaters. And now you see that the money system is exactly that. The animals were locked in by the fences and were given fodder so that they could live and so that they could work. Now laws have replaced the fences, and the money has replaced the hay. So now people are locked up behind these bars, and actually when somebody studies law, they do the bar exam. So once they've done the bar exam, they can put the bars in place by which people can no longer move. And then people are given food in the form of money. I'll come to that in a bit. So people who get food, get money, can get food. People who do not get money cannot get food. So the people with the money can prosper, they can work for the slaveholders, they can do all kinds of things which they might think to be nice. The people who are not fed, who don't have the money, they starve, basically they have a decrepit life, they can minimally do things what they want to do. So money is at the same time a reward and a punishment. So in that sense, back again to the flail and the shepherd's staff. With the shepherd's staff you can dish out things, and with the flail you can also use it to beat things. So in that approach, giving money is a reward, withholding money is a punishment. That has been set up throughout the whole economy now, and people believe that they need to have money to do things, and they will do all kind of things to make sure that they get money. That has led to a technique which you also find in, say, the concentration camps, and regardless if it is Palestine or if it is the Nazi concentration camp, or if it is the Roman circus, this has been done for a very long time. In the concentration camp, you often find that a group of people is fenced in, like cattle, and then they're not given enough food to live on. For example, the Americans did that to the Germans after the war. Those were the Rhein-Meadow concentration camps. So millions of Germans were put on a meadow in a fence without enough food, no shelter, and many, many Germans died there. And it was just a way of Morgenthau and the American government at that time to, in a way, take ceremonial revenge for the concentration camps. And in the concentration camps and in the other camps, you saw that people who were prisoner were selected. Some of the stronger were selected out, and they were promised and sometimes given privileges like more food, boots, a coat, cigarettes. And in exchange for that, they were then tasked to coordinate, control, regulate, and if necessary punish the other people in the concentration camp, in the prison. So these Kampfpolizei or Kapos were prisoners who had been upgraded so that they would suppress the other prisoners. And this is the typical Roman divide and rule. So you get some of the people, pitch them against the others. And as a result, you find that everywhere in the money system, there are people who are rewarded more than other people, as a result of which they will control and suppress the other people. This has also been done in many cultures. Michel Foucault described this when he looked at the French setting, where the government would make sure that there were areas in the country where people were impoverished, where there was not enough money going on, and where by rules and regulations people could not develop the things that they needed to survive. And these people were according to Foucault, kept in this condition so that everybody could point at the middle class and say, well, you're not as bad off as those guys there. And of course, the poor people would at some point become miserable, because lack of food leads to starvation. Lack of food leads thereby to diseases, and disease will lead to either death or rebellion. So at the moment that the tribes then rebelled, some of the better fed other people, let's say the capos of the society, would be pulled in. They would then capture the most aggressive animals, and that's where the Darwinian story is so much liked by this group of people who puts this kind of things in place. So they would capture the more vital, more energetic people from the resistance, and then either offer them a job to become police, to police all of the other people, so that they could actually police their own. Or if they didn't accept that, they would recruit them for the army so that they could fight against others, as they were rebels anyhow, as they were fighting anyhow, as they might as well get killed fighting against other rebels, fighting for other corporate nations. And if they didn't do that, then they could always be put to the galleys, so they would get a job to basically task and work like slaves for whoever had captured them. And if that didn't work, they could always banish them to the colonies and get rid of them, and basically use them as people to put a colony in place and either build roads there or build farms there or whatever. But in any case, this was a whole description that Michel Foucault provides of the way that the poor are instrumental in, on the one hand, suppressing the poor, on the other hand, doing tasks which nobody wants to do, such as killing other people or putting other countries into a better shape. But most important is that they also have the role of the scare tactics, so that the other people, the middle class, is kept in place, because there is the threat that if you don't work, you won't get money and you will end up like them there. So money has been used to put a lot of society under lock and key, and nowadays you see that extensively, because where people used to have money in their pocket, they now have a plastic card with a code number in their pocket. And evidently, if you lose that plastic card, you suddenly have no access to, in many cases, you can no longer get onto a train or a tram if you don't have a card like that. In many places, you cannot go into shops, other places, if you don't have a card like that. So people have become totally tied up with that money system, and that is now being elaborated, that in what they call a cashless society, which means that people can no longer use money to pay for anything. If they want to pay for something, they always need to identify themselves. So the difference between a cash money society and a cashless society is that in a cash-based society, people have anonymity. They can just rob anybody or work for anybody or prostitute themselves to anybody in whatever way that they acquire money. They can then use that money from anonymity. They are then the holder of that money, and however much they have or however little they have, they can negotiate with somebody who needs it more and will do anything or will do not do something for that money. So money is a control system. And actually, when you look at it at that level, then the control of money is not in the value of money, but the control of money is by the regulations under which money operates. So anybody who uses money is immediately part of a system of laws, not the national laws, but the laws of money. And it is really important to understand that the laws of money are separate. They're based on the Uniform Commercial Code, which comes from the shippers in the Mediterranean. And in order to understand that, we need to go back to the past, need to shift the perspective. Instead of looking at Egypt, we now need to look at Babylon. Because in Babylon, you can see the other part of the equation. In Egypt, money was used, and in Egypt, geometry was created to size up a piece of farmland. And of course, if you know how large a piece of farmland is, you can also guesstimate how much harvest would come out of that. So geometry was there to size up the land, and algebra was there to see how much of the produce on the land would have to go to the pharaoh. So both formed the system of taxation. In Babylon, they used a tallying record-keeping system using clay icons. So if, for example, if you had a bag of flour and you brought that to the ship, then you would get a little piece of clay back looking like a bag of flour. And if you bought a barrel of oil, then you would get a little piece of clay back to show that you brought a barrel of oil. So at the starting point of this trading system, people would have the little clay effigies of what they were dealing with. Later it turned out that if you had brought 21 pieces of bags of wheat, you would get 21 of these little images of wheat in clay. But they could rub against each other and could break, so they started a practice of wrapping them in a clay envelope, and then on it they wrote how many little symbols it contained. At some point they realized that they could do without putting the little symbols in, they just wrote it on top. And that's where an administration came in place, where numbers and letters developed in order to indicate what was being traded and how much of it. So this system of record keeping was done by the scribes, just like in Egypt. It was the scribes who collected the taxes and who kept record. The same in Babylon, the scribes kept record of what was going on. And in both cases, it was a tribe which had no relationship to the people there, but who had come to live there. And presumably that tribe was the Hebrew tribe from the area of Judah. So they were the migrant worker for the Egyptians, they were the migrant worker for the Babylonians, and they were working with these tax systems and trade administration systems. And of course, as a result, they also had a written historic record, which is why these peoples are known as the book-based belief societies, because they kept the track records. At some point in that area, a shift took place because the Egyptians realized that the scribes that they had were too nice to the people that were there, so they thought that the tax farming, that's the term for it, would be done better by strangers. So at some point they discovered that the Greeks were willing to do that, for a fee of course, and tax harvesting basically meant that the tax farmer, which is basically like one of these capos in a concentration camp, suppressing the others so that he gets a better benefit from it, they would pay an amount to the pharaoh, and then they would collect it back from the people where the pharaoh said, okay, you can essentially plunder them and get the money back from that. Charles Adams described that part of the story, and he said that there was a time that this went awry, this was really turning nasty, because once a Greek had paid the pharaoh, he would go out and get the payback from the people in the region where he could collect the taxes, and that could lead to nasty kind of situations. So nasty that at some point the pharaoh decided that if the tax collectors were misbehaving as he heard, then he would just cut off their noses. I always find it funny that a Sphinx doesn't have a nose, so there might be a relationship in that, but in any case that seemed to have cured the problem. But something else happened, as we can see, because the Ptolemaian pharaohs were Greeks, so somehow these import Greeks who collected the taxes for the Egyptians became not just the tax collectors but the one who spent the money as well. And so over the years you can then see that with the geometry and the algebra on the Egyptian side, with the calculus of the trading from the Babylonian side, both of that came together in the shipping, where in the Mediterranean Sea, on the Mediterranean Sea, the farmers would bring their wares to the ship, would get a token of what they had brought there. The ship would then sail it across to Rome or to Venice, to Europe. Venice was the gateway to the Germans and Rome was the gateway to the Italians. Of course, it also went to Spain, to France, and so on. So all of these traders by ship, they somehow needed to have a system of security by which the farmers would know that what they brought there, they would get their values back. And that led to the foundation of the banking system in what's now known as the Uniform Commercial Code. It is a code of shipping, and it is really important to understand that we there have the difference between the farm and the ship. When they talk about the ship of state, it is intentional, because a ship is not a farm. A farm is always ecological, is always connected to nature, is always a collaboration of people, and they always themselves produce whatever they live with and live off. It is integrally connected to nature, so the only way that you can have a farm is that you give care to the earth. For the ship, this is different. The ship is like a little island, nothing can grow there. The only way that you can get things in there is where you get it from somewhere else. So the easiest way to understand that is by the Viking ships who raided Europe. So they would, after the harvest season, sail out, go to the places where the farmers had brought in the harvest. Then they would rob the harvest, rob the damsels, and go back home. at some point they found that essentially too much work. So, for example, you see that at some point the Danes would go up and down to England to rob them, get the produce off the land, get the damsels, go back home. And of course they would go at the end of the summer and would have to go back at autumn where the storms are. So at some point it was unsafe, so instead they just captured one of the villages on the coast, and the next season from that village they plundered the rest of the villages. And then when you look at the history of England, you can see that at some point from the coast they plundered the rest of the country. And nowadays you can see that the Normans are the upper class of England and the lower class of England are the Saxons. So basically the Normans did their plundering with their ships, and that philosophy of the ship and the philosophy of piracy is part of what we see still. So the tax office is basically the Viking who has parked his ship on the land, turned it over and said, from now on it's a tax office, and rather than me go and rob it, you go and bring it to us, because otherwise who knows what happens. So again, it's the story of Cain and Abel, that one part of humanity is trying to live off the other part of humanity, is trying to rob them. And that is what you also see in the difference between the farm and the ship. Coming back to the Uniform Commercial Code, on the Mediterranean, the shipping became basically the principle of law for the trading. But in shipping, you have to see if there are farmers having produce. Then you have to see that somehow you can get the ship from one side of the Mediterranean to the other. You know that there will be losses because of storms. Sometimes these ships sink. And sometimes you will find that if your cargo is lost by a storm, you could repair your ship and get the cargo of another ship. So pirates are part of the story. So if you have a system of trading in which losses by natural disasters and losses by human disaster are sort of normal, then you can understand that the accounting system for that will always take that into account, quite literally. So you also find that the bookkeeping system of the bankers is now intimately connected to the system of assurance, the insurers of losses, against losses. So even though they pretend to be separate institutions, they're actually part of the same institution, because the banking system is the accounting system of, say, how many wares there are on board of the ship. The difference is that they upgraded the notion of the ship to encompass the land. And that, of course, makes it very confusing, because then suddenly the principles of the piracy of the ship is applied to the whole land, which, of course, explains a lot of the wars that are going on, because if your land is not doing so well, instead of cultivating the land, you go to the neighbors, rob them blind, and then bring the harvest and the damsels back to your land and hope that the other guys are weakened so much that they won't come back and grab it back again. So a lot of the laws which exist at the moment are very confused and very confusing, because the laws of the sea and the laws of the land are different. In a way, they are opposite. And the laws of the land are essentially about the habits of people and the agreements between people on how they can help each other, and also on how they can prevent mishaps amongst each other. While the laws of the sea are about accounting and bookkeeping, essentially of debt and obligations. And you can also see that in the American legal system, where the court is actually still in the shape of the ship. So you can see that there is these benches, there are it is as if they put a ship on the land. And in many of the law systems there are actually comments that there will be a reference to when it was high water in that area. So when they referred to land, and for example, everybody who's living on rock, which is sedimentation rock, the bankers say, well, that is part of the sea. So basically, we have authority here. And there are many hidden and indirect and explicit and direct references to this system of the laws of the sea, or the laws of piracy, which are now operating in the financial system. So, for example, when you see the American flag, that would be the land of the Constitution. By the way, the word Constitution means a financial assurance arrangement. So the American flag would be the law of the Constitution of the land. But when you see this gold rim trim around the edges, then suddenly you're dealing with the Admiralty flag. So suddenly you're under the jurisdiction of the laws of the sea. And in the business of the law courts, you see that they will flip between the one and the other legal system essentially at will, to confuse you, to enslave you, to ensnare you. And if you look at the court of law in America, then you see that they have business hours and that they operate as a pirate ship, and that in fact it is always under the admiralty law and the financial law. So it's a business. It is not a system for arbitration of conflicts between people, but it is a commercial enterprise by which the conflict of between people are turned into financial gain and losses. Again, all of that is based on what happened in Egypt, what happened in Babylon, the bookkeeping system that came out of that, and the whole track-keeping system, which is found in the Uniform Commercial Code of the Mediterranean shipping trading. There is a history to the way this developed. The Romans tried to get rid of the Phoenicians because they were good traders and they had a different code. They were not into robbing people, they were into trading with people. The Romans then learned that if they took over the trick of the Egyptians, which the Greeks had already done, then instead of being the Caesar, the leader of the country, they could be the god in the country. So that would make them beyond any human law. So nobody could get at them anymore. So the Romans for a while tried that. That didn't work too well. Caesar tried, he got killed. The Flavius family tried. Basically they had the war against the Jews, which then led to the creation of the New Testament as a political instrument to basically suppress the Jewish peoples by calling them Christians. Then they turned the state of Rome into the Church of Rome. The legions became then the legions of the church. According to one researcher, there were six families in Rome who together created the Vatican. And of course the Pope then has three crowns, one in which he claims that he's owner of the earth, another crown in which he claims that he's owner of everything living on earth, and one crown in which he claims that he's owner of the soul of everything on earth. And if you understand the terminology, that means that he's the upper slave keeper of the planet. Because if you own the soul, you own their freedom of choice. And that is so nicely described in the story of Faustus. Let me tell the story of Faustus now already, even though in history it comes much later, because the story of Faustus refers right back to the basis of all of it. By Robert Marlowe, it was described as God and the devil are playing a game of dice. I'm sort of transcribing the story a bit. God says there is this really devout guy, he's so good, he's so wonderful, he's a doctor, he's knowledgeable, and he's called Faustus. And he's so pious, it's just great, it's wonderful, it's so wonderful. And the devil says, well, you say so, but I think that if I play with a guy, you'll find that he's less than pious. He will happily go against the principles that you value so much. So they haggle a bit. It turns out that in the end, God loses the game of dice. The devil can play with Faustus. So he goes up to Faustus and says, "Good guy, I hear you're so wonderful and you're so pious, so devout. But I wonder, why is it that I haven't heard of you before? I think that somebody in your state should have fame and fortune and sign here on the dotted line with your blood. And what you sign away is your soul. So you'll get all these wonderful things, all at the price of selling your soul." So the story of Faustus got very well known. In signing with your blood, you sign with your life force, so you bleed yourself dry in a bit, so that you can sign your soul away to the other, but your soul is of course your freedom of choice. So you sign away your life blood, you sign away your soul, so basically you have become the slave of somebody else, in this case the devil, more specifically the banker. So Faustus then gets everything that money can offer. So he gets the fame and the fortune, and he has a good time, all the fast cars, the fast girls, the fast planes, and so on. And at the end of the ride, he realizes that he's going to go to hell. Well, basically, at the time of Robert Marlowe, that was the debtor's prison. So you would be locked up, no food, the family would have to feed you. Lack of hygiene, of everything, nasty people around, and not a good place to be. And in Marlowe's time, that was it. So in his book, Faustus then has to go to hell. Later, Johann von Goethe rewrote the story. He was the minister of salt of Bavaria. Salt is the base of the word of salary. So salary is equal to money. So he was basically there with an understanding of the bankers. So in his story, at the end of the ride, Faustus calls up the devil and says, "By the way, let me see the contract that we have, because I want to see what was your collateral. What did you put in where I signed away my life?" And then, of course, it turns out that the banker never produced anything in making the money. He just printed money, and there was no counter value, because the banker has no counter value. So then Faustus goes free. And the story of Faustus is so important, because the understanding that the banker never puts in a counter value is essential to see the deceptive event that is taking place in what bankers are doing at the moment. So they promise people that they get all this wonderful money. I already spoke about the interest, that people never get all of the money that they need to pay back. But in the bankruptcy process, the bankers get 10% or whatever percentage they have at that time of the interest of whatever the debtors will need to sell. So in this way, say it's 10%, and say you come back 10 years later, 10 times 10% is 100%. So 10 years later, the bankers basically own everything. They just know that they can't own it, because it was never there, so they just resell it to everybody. But every time they harvest on the work of others. For example, if you buy a house and you get a mortgage done, whatever the mortgage is, you will pay as much to the bankers generally as you pay for the house. That just depends on how long you take to pay back. So why is it that for every house you buy, the banker can buy two or three houses? And why is it also that when you use the bank money, the bankers say, "Well, actually, there is inflation." And inflation is actually that bankers produce money for themselves, but they never declare it. So they dilute the value of money. And in Europe, that's put at 3%. So the government says, "Well, we really got things under control. Inflation is only 3%. No, it means that the government with the bankers agreed that the bankers may make 3% money, which is not accounted for by anything else, so that 3% money without any accountability is diluting the rest of the money. And of course, if you add that up, then 15 years later of interest upon interest, you have already lost half of the value of the money, whatever money it is. So the money system is a system of multiple taxations, and the system as a whole is based on people not knowing that money is a fiction, and people not knowing how you can make your own money. There is a lot more to the story about money and the deception going on about it, the Egyptian magic, the taxation system, the way money has been used and abused throughout the ages. But I'd like to bring it to the other side of the story, because the story of money is described in purgatory.plantingparadise.org. It is part of four stories, and I need those four stories first before I can describe the simple solution to making money. First, I need to point out these four stories, and they are about the four dimensions of our reality. The reality that we live in is three-dimensional. It's in front of you, behind you, left and right, and top and bottom of you. So whichever direction you go, you find reality. So it is, say, the video game that we live in, that we grow up in as creators in creation. And it is a space in which we define what we live, how we live, for ourselves and with other. And our participation in creation has two sides of it. On the one hand, it is the environment, three-dimensional, that we find around ourselves. And on the other hand, it is within us, the capacity to operate freedom of choice, which is zero-dimensional. Basically, it's flipping a point around its own axis, flipping a quantum. So freedom of choice is zero-dimensional, and the reality and the realization of reality is three-dimensional. But between them, there are two distorted forms of realization, and those are the forms that this culture at the moment is trapped in. Normally, when people interact, they will feel their aura, and they will interact via the aura, and the aura is, say, the surface area by which you interact to the area around you. But that domain of two-dimensional interaction, the surface is two-dimensional, that domain of two-dimensional interaction with others has now been taken over by what's called the system of law, which is a very specific form of belief. It comes out of the book-based beliefs, as I said, that has the origin in the scribes in Egypt, which were the bankers, or the administrators, the clerks of the bankers. And so then you find that the laws which exist are two-dimensional. They're the pieces of paper by which the reality that people can live in are limited. And note that these kind of laws, as described in the Bible as the tablets of Moses, and the Jewish system has these laws, the Muslim system has these laws, the Christian system has these laws. Actually, together they form one system. I call that Judeo-Christlam. They basically have the same book, sort of reinterpreted for a different consumer society, and they reformulated their ideas accordingly. But all of them say that what is written in the book is more real than reality. Of course, that's not true. Reality is three-dimensional. What's written on paper is only two-dimensional. So there's one dimension that has been lost. So whatever you can formulate on paper can no longer be real. You go from three-dimensional reality to two-dimensional reality. And everybody who's tried to keep a diary, and everyone who ever read a newspaper, knows that whatever is written on paper is not true. You cannot show on paper, which is two-dimensional, what is happening in the world around us, which is three-dimensional. You lose the dimension. So the reality of law, which is two-dimensional, is not representative for the reality that we know. It's a reduced, limited, in fact often crippled, and most often abusing version of that reality. So there are very great problems in the legal systems in many countries. Also because in the legal system it often says who can formulate the laws, who can reformulate them, and how people who are trying to remake the laws are dealt with. And that also implies that the people who uphold the law can then make it impossible for other people to rewrite the law. So that's where you have group interests using the laws to suppress and oppress the other people. It's not a healthy situation. The situation gets worse when you look at money, because where laws are interactional, money is transactional. So laws are like the doors or the windows or the walls or the keyholes between one person and the other. The laws determine how people can relate, if you believe in that system. And the money system is the transaction through the wall, through the doors, through the windows, through the chin, and so on. So where you interact from one side to the other, where you pass something from you to the other, it's like a handshake. And a handshake is linear, it's one-dimensional. So money, the whole system of money, is one-dimensional. So it's one dimension less than that legal system, it's two dimensions less than that reality system. So the system of money can never be at the level of the system of law. It is in a totally different dimension, it's in the lower dimension. So you cannot trust anything which comes out of money. As I say, money has no value. As they say in some cultures, money, the value of money is just what the madman gives it. It is just a symbolic notation. It has no value in itself. So whatever you try to agree on a value of money is never real. That's also why money can have inflation. That's also why for one piece of gold in Roman times you get exactly as much as you can get for that same piece of gold in present times. Because the value of money is subjective to these belief systems. Before I go into the description of how you make your own money, I still need to build a bridge between the money of the past and the money of the present. In the past, as I described, the people of the desert conquered, enslaved, and suppressed the people of the delta, treating them as cattle, keeping them in slavery. And all of the money systems and all of the legal systems are part of that construct. That's not very healthy. In order to make it possible for the slaves to work, you needed food. So food came from the land. So the original cash crop for money or for value was how many slaves could you keep working, which was then calculated in how much food did you have available for the slaves to keep working. And actually the word oikonomia from Greek was like the household book of how many grain you needed to have at the end of summer so that the sheep and ducks and the people on the farm could live through the winter where nothing could grow. Of course, accounting for the fact that some of the sheep and some of the ducks would get slaughtered on the way around Christmas and other times. So they would need less grain. So of the amount of grain that you first calculated, you could then subtract a bit because that sheep would not eat the rest of the grain for the rest of the season. So that's oikonomia. So once you had that notion that the farmland is actually the food and that the food is the work of the people, then you can understand that landowners was a measure for how rich you were, because that's the amount of food you had, that's the amount of people that you could get work for you. So then the ownership of land was turned into symbols. So those were papers, but likewise the ownership of food, there it was more clear to see how that worked, because in traders you would have traders move grain from one area to the other, so you would know how much food that would be, and you could use counters for a bag of food. As I said, the Babylonians, you made a little clay effigy of the bag of food, and then you could show that I produced this bag of food, and I have this token here that I have been credited for producing that bag of food. I'll be back in just a moment. One moment, please.